This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Wonders of the World, Trials or Ordeals of the Soul, and Revelations of the Spirit. This is Lecture 10, the last lecture in this cycle. We have been able to show in the course of these lectures how people at different times have formed ideas about what actually is hidden within the beings and events of the world. Also, through the fact that man forms certain ideas and feelings with regard to these events and beings, he acquires a feeling of satisfaction, for he realizes that he thus comes in touch with certain things, and gains, to some extent, an explanation of cosmic secrets. He discovers that he does not face the world simply as he is, but in addition to what is evident to his senses and to his clairvoyant cognition, he can strive for a deeper knowledge about what at first is hidden from him, so that he may stand in true harmony with the world. The very fact that he is seeking for an explanation of the world shows that this world presents him with riddles, and that his connection with it does not end the same as when it first confronted him. Expression was given to this in olden times, for we must keep in mind the feeling people had regarding the most outstanding beings and facts of the world's evolution. It has been said that man has first of all a feeling of wonder toward all things and beings, that out of this feeling of wonder all philosophy and everything that man strives after as an explanation of the world has sprung. Note by editor C. Wordsworth in The Renaissance of Wonder. We see how from such experiences, which are felt by everyone, this is Steiner again, the soul of man now strives after something that checks or does away with this wonder. The soul cannot remain stationary, lost in mere wonder, for in that case the world would consist for the soul only of wonder. The human soul cannot remain stationary with its wonderment in the face of cosmic miracles. It must abate the wonder by finding through herself an answer to the riddles, the phenomena, and the entities of the world. We have seen, for example, how the ancient Greek soul disembarrassed itself in the most varied way of this wonder by sending a piercing glance into what was present to ancient clairvoyant consciousness as an explanation of the world, and to which the Greek soul gave expression in the forms of his gods. So soon as the Greek knew that in this or in that fact or object spiritual forms were at work, which he represented in the forms of the Greek mythology, this feeling of wonder was transformed into a feeling that a kind of harmony existed between man's own soul and the, quote, wonders of the world, close quote. In our day, which, compared to that of the Greeks, is very materialistic, we think otherwise. While our age deems it necessary to quench the feeling of wonder, it is averse to answer the riddles of the universe by means of pictorial forms. The age in which we live would consider such an answer fantastic, were it offered as an explanation of the facts of the world. Our age strives for an answer to these riddles that can be considered scientific. From the varied perceptions, however, that may have been evoked in the course of these and other lectures, you can gather that the intellectual, prosaic, dry, scientific method, which is customary today, is but a phase in the effort to stifle wonderment regarding the wonders of the world. For when man looks back with his so-called scientific methods upon Greek cosmogony and calls it childish, feeling as though it had sprung only from fantasy and had nothing to do with realities, and when he thinks that he has discovered something that will remain scientific for all time, we can but reply that he is very short-sighted. For just as man's progress has pressed forward beyond the form of explanation given by the Greeks, and has reached in our time a correspondingly prosaic and intellectual development of it, even so will this intellectual materialistic edifice he has built up be superseded. And if meanwhile we have become no cleverer, we shall think in the future, regarding what now passes for true science, even as we think about Hellenism today. Our descendants will consider the laws of Kepler or our own biological laws just as mythological as Greek mythology appears to us, if they fail to realize that through a wider outlook on the world, each kind of explanation stands justified in its place. The infinite arrogance of our time, which declares that mythology was mere fancy, and that our science at last makes all things clear, will be overcome. And it will be seen that our age provides a phase which must be overcome, just as did the earlier ages. It is when we consider the prosaic, matter-of-fact explanation of the world which is called science in the outside world that we feel compelled to remark that it is precisely this kind of explanation of the world, with its cut-and-dried formula and matter-of-fact concepts, that is least able to penetrate to true realities. We must seriously try to answer the question as to what is the cause of this. When we take into consideration the whole spirit of the lectures we have had so far, and that of the many others during all the time I have been lecturing, you must allow that the way in which man regards the world has changed very much in the course of time. Man has become different. And in the ancient days of clairvoyance, much stronger, much more powerful forces within the human being had to be reckoned with than is the case today. In such merely materialistic explanations, the soul, through the instrumentality of the brain, gives birth to the flimsiest, most shadowy forms in the ideas and conceptions it provides as an explanation of the world. The old explanations of more or less clairvoyant times were far fuller of the sap of life, far fuller of reality. In the last lecture, I showed how our brain is a kind of instrument or apparatus which brings our astral body to a standstill, permitting the creations of this astral body to reach our consciousness as thoughts of the outer world, because they are not allowed a free passage through our brain. In the time of the old clairvoyant consciousness, not only the creations of the astral body were kept back by man, but those of the etheric body also. And the consequence was that a much greater part of his own self, of his own psychic substance, was permitted to pass into the creations of his intelligence. Expressed diagrammatically, we might say, the old clairvoyance, even the old Greek vision, much more disposed as it was to fantasy, was such that when a thought of Zeus or Dionysus rose before the soul of the Greek, it was replete with a reality which certainly sprang in the first place from the man's own soul substance. But because this had its origin in all the profundities of the world, such an idea of their gods as was formed by the old Greeks contained much more reality than the thought pictures of a later age. If I were to represent the thoughts of the old Greeks by a circle, I should have to draw the thoughts of a modern man as much more thinly filled with soul substance than theirs. The human soul takes much less and much thinner substance from itself when it creates the forms of modern ideas. So that, in the representations of the world which the soul forms with the consciousness of today, there is much less cosmic reality than in the earlier pictures. The truth, therefore, is really just the opposite of what for the most part is imagined by the learned philosophical arrogance of the moderns. It holds that the forms of the Greek gods were but fanciful ideas, in which there was no reality, that reality only exists in modern natural laws, with all their abstractions. The reverse is the case. The creations of Greek cognition were much more densely filled with true reality. Compared with them, the knowledge that comes to us today through the laws of nature is but like a squeezed-out lemon. That is something which the soul can feel when it is not biased by modern scientific pride, but thirsts for its consciousness to be replenished with reality. It is when our soul feels this thirst for reality, she is most aware that in what is offered to her nowadays, especially in what is called strict science, she is most enmeshed in maya or illusion. Never before was there in the world such an entanglement of illusions as in the creations of modern philosophy or in scientific methods of thought. Why has this come about? Because in the course of his earth development, man had to develop his present ego consciousness. For this, he had to be quite independent, alone with himself, with his ego. For this purpose, he had to be lured away from his connection with the world beyond. The strong, substantial content, which would have made it possible for him to instill as much psychic substance into his creations as was the case with the figures of the Greek gods, would have made it impossible for him to attain his ego consciousness, because he would have been too much poured out or distributed over the whole world. In order that man might become strong in regard to his ego consciousness, he had to be separated from cosmic realities, so that in regard to these cosmic realities, his soul had to be made infinitely weak for objective cognition of the world. Consequently, because the human soul is now especially adapted to the development of the ego consciousness, it is at its very weakest in respect of the conditions which it once experienced. Owing to this particular weakness, which we had to develop, those poverty-stricken ideas, so meagerly filled with reality, had to enter our modern consciousness. Anyone who had been educated according to the learning and belief in authority of the present day, which dwells in mere abstractions, will certainly never arrive at feeling the infinite poverty of his soul with regard to true reality. If, however, he feels within him the thirst for union with the reality of the world, at a certain point in his life the feeling comes over him, quote, "Oh, how in all the ideas of today I feel estranged from true reality, how I feel as though amid mere external shadows," close quote. This might be expressed in external scientific form, and you find it so expressed in a small work I published some time ago on Goethe's theory of cognition called, quote, "Truth and Science." It's also called "Truth and Knowledge," close quote. There it is shown that man, through the fact that he has arrived at ordinary intellectual knowledge, attains only to a portion of knowledge and of truth, and that he is pressing forward to another condition of the world than that offered to him at present. This is along a scientific path, which is entirely practicable, although to the philosophy of the day it may sound somewhat incomprehensible. But on the other hand, the endeavor arises to penetrate by means of the esoteric path into a more living reality than that provided by the mere abstract laws of the reason. When the soul feels that with the present-day normal consciousness, it can only form ideas that are illusion in comparison with life-filled reality, then if it is not of the squeezed lemon genus, which recognizes only the science of the day, it feels empty in respect of world reality. Then it feels indeed that through ideas it can attain to the farthest limits of the world. But in this case it takes no note of the saying in the second drama, The Soul's Probation, page 151, I guess, quote, "End not at last in cosmic distances," close quote. For he who in all seriousness desires to end at the farthest limits of the world would perforce be overcome by a feeling as if with ideas which were as yet weak in themselves he were spread out over infinite space. There they would become still more attenuated, and the further we penetrate into these distant regions, the thinner do they become, till with our ideas we stand before a fathomless, empty abyss. This does actually come to pass as a trial of the soul. He whose soul thirsts for reality, he who in accordance with abstract science seeks to solve the riddles and wonders of the world, will in the end have to face this void, with his ideas completely dissolved as in a spiritual mist. The soul will then have to experience infinite terror in the presence of this void. He who does not experience such fear is simply not yet far enough advanced to realize the truth regarding present-day consciousness. Thus, when we seek to expand the present-day consciousness into infinite space, there is this terrifying spectacle to be faced, this horror in face of the cosmic void, and this no one can be spared, who takes seriously what is meant by the normal consciousness of the present day. The soul must pass through such, in quotes, trials, if it desires to experience the meaning and the spirit of our age. It must experience, at some time, the abyss which opens out on all sides when we seek to penetrate the vast fields of space with our ideas. The soul must feel this limitless dread of the void, this dread of losing itself in cosmic space, in the vast reaches of the universe. If we are acquainted with the expression in Goethe's conception of the cosmos, quote, of becoming one, close quote, with the world, of expanding one's being till it is a world, then we shall have to say, when by means of present-day understanding, one has gone forth into infinite space, and endeavored according to the principles of modern philosophy, which must always be abstract because they are taken from present-day consciousness, to understand the world, then every healthy soul must undergo the test of standing before the abyss that opens on all sides, must experience the fear of being dissipated in endless naught with the best part of one's being, with that which constitutes consciousness. This feeling is a general one, and all other feelings that accompany these trials of the soul are only varieties of this fear in presence of the void, this horror vacui. It would be unhealthy for the narrowly limited life of the soul if one did not experience how the modern consciousness is pulverized and shattered to pieces against the infinite universe as soon as it seeks to expand to this universe. That is the fate of the soul today, when it seeks to penetrate with its present-day consciousness into the remote distances and expanses of the cosmos. There is another path which the soul may choose. It is that wherein she plunges down into her own depths, so that in this descent she experiences her own organism. As our soul enters with its consciousness into the life of today, it really experiences only that which, on the earth, it has added to its organism. What was accrued in the old moon as astral body is the subconsciousness which flashes up in the etheric body, but is not yet experienced in normal consciousness. Still less does a man experience what was acquired during the solar period as the etheric body, or even what was acquired as physical body through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon ages, and during our Earth age. Those regions are closed to him, but on these closed regions countless generations of gods, of spiritual hierarchies, have labored. Certainly, when we descend thither, by means of clairvoyant cognition or through esoteric training, and penetrate behind our ego consciousness into our own being, and meet what is within us as astral, etheric, and physical body, we then come not to a void, but to a much more solid cosmic substantiality. All that countless spiritual hierarchies have worked into us men in the course of millions and millions of years is met with down there. When a person desires to experience, by means of serious self-cognition, such as is given by esoteric training, what has been accomplished by countless generations of divine beings through millions of years, he does not meet it in a pure form, for man has dragged down into this realm all that he himself has added to it throughout the generations, in the way of impulses, desires, passions, tendencies, and instincts. What he has thus developed has become united in the course of the earth incarnations with what is contained in the astral, etheric, and physical bodies. This forms a dense mass, and it is into this that we at first enter. This dense mass veils from us our own divine nature, which is hidden by what we ourselves have dragged into it, so that when we plunge down into our own selves, we discover the opposite of what we find when we go forth into the expanses of the universe. When we force our way out into the wide expanses of space, there is danger of eventually standing before the void. When we penetrate into ourselves, there is the danger of coming into ever denser regions, which we have solidified through our impulses, desires, and passions. Just as we feel the substance of our consciousness shattered and destroyed when we go forth into space, so when we go down into the depths of our own soul, we feel more and more as if we were resisted, as an India rubber ball resists when it is squeezed. When we seek to descend into our innermost being, we are always thrown back again by our own selves. We can observe this very well. It is not only that our impulses, desires, and passions, which we first encounter when we enter into our own being, appear so appalling when we directly confront them, but further, that at each moment they seem as though they would lay hold of us. They wax strong and powerful. Their will nature especially is in evidence. Whereas in our ordinary consciousness we do not follow this or that impulse, so soon as we dip but a short distance into ourselves, those impulses and instincts immediately develop their whole force, and we cannot do otherwise than give way to them. We are continually gripped by an independent will of a lower nature, dwelling within us, and are thrown back into ourselves more evil than we were before. Thus, when we plunge down into ourselves, we are confronted with the dense mass of our own impulses and instincts. That is the other danger. We stand before two immense dangers. When we force our way into cosmic realms, we are in danger of completely losing ourselves, that is, our consciousness, in the void. And when we plunge down into the depths of our own being, we are in danger of subjecting all consciousness to the impulses and instincts which are in our nature, and of falling into the greatest possible egoism. These are the two poles between which lie all trials or probations of the soul: horror of the void and falling a prey to egoism. All other trials of the soul are variations on what on one side may be called the pole of extinction in the void, and the other the pole of destruction through egoism. In this connection, the higher knowledge is dangerous. For what do we learn by means of this higher knowledge? We learn how countless spiritual hierarchies have worked upon us, how our physical, etheric, and astral bodily nature in all its parts is put together by the hierarchies, how the spirits of the universe have labored so that man at last might come into being. When a man has entered esoterically into his inner depths, he begins to feel, quote, "Thou hast really been the goal and aim of the gods. They have worked to produce thee," close quote. Then comes the great danger of man's falling into unbounded pride. Capasius is terrified by this pride when he hears from the mouth of Felix Balda how the spiritual hierarchies have worked, and how man is the object of all the labor of the gods. This is the meaning underlying the alarm of Capasius. It is a part of his soul's probation that he should experience it. Hence the need that man should approach the knowledge that he is the goal of the gods, humbly, that he should contemplate that fact in humility. Otherwise it leads to presumption. For when we realize that man is the goal of the gods, every opportunity exists for arrogance and presumption. Every opportunity for this exists in the macrocosm, when we see the gods continually exerting all their efforts to develop that which is the being of man. It is well that we should form rather more concrete ideas as to how the gods have worked on the conformation and development of man. Through the Saturn age, the seraphim and the thrones worked in cooperation with the spirits of personality. Through the sun period, the cherubim and the spirits of wisdom worked with the archangels. During the old moon period, the seraphim worked with the spirits of movement and angels. And the spirits of form were also at work. Can we on the earth still note anything of the effect of this activity on human formation from without? We touch here on a remarkable phenomenon of our recent intellectual life. In reality, there is nothing that offers so many proofs of an esoteric kind regarding all that is proclaimed through spiritual science as the facts of modern science. The way in which modern science has developed its facts during the past 10 years affords everywhere proof of what is taught here. These facts, however, are often least understood by those who discover them, and their explanation by external science and philosophy is again the greatest hindrance to the understanding of spiritual science. The facts themselves are a proof. The present-day explanations of these facts are everywhere a hindrance. That is a remarkable phenomenon. In various places I have referred to certain of these facts. From the spirit of many of my lectures, you may conclude that the brain was the last part of man to be evolved. The rest of the organism was evolved earlier by the spirits of the various hierarchies. But our partial subconsciousness still continues to have an effect on the organization of the brain in a manner that can be observed today. Only the beautiful and wonderful facts which modern science gives us are not interpreted in the correct way. Let us consider an example. In April of this year, the 50th anniversary of a very important discovery of modern science was celebrated, which, when it is rightly understood, stands as witness for a very complete justification of the theory of evolution as taught by spiritual science. The results of spiritual science are only to be discovered by means of clairvoyance. But these discoveries can be justified through the facts put forward by external science. This year the Jubilee was celebrated of a most important address delivered by Broca, the great physician and philosopher, in April 1861, before the Anthropological Society in Paris, regarding his discovery of the seat of articulate speech. What was put forward by Broca proved conclusively that in the laws inherent to the physical brain, no indication was to be found of what produced the configuration of that special part of the brain which leads to the consciousness of the art of speech, or to comprehension of the sound of speech. As Broca discovered the instrument of speech in the third convolution of the brain, and that this instrument must be in a healthy state if man is to understand the sound of speech, so he also found that another part must also be in a healthy state if man is to be able to express himself. This discovery was a great advance on previous knowledge, and is a confirmation of facts already put forward by spiritual science. Why is this? Because of the way in which the center of speech is formed. For it is shown that it is the external movements made by a man, the movements of his hands, for instance, that is, his half-conscious gestures, that operate in the formation of this center of speech. Why is the center of speech in man's brain especially developed on the left side? Because in accordance with the requirements of civilization at the present time, the right hand is mainly employed. It is the etheric and astral bodies which bring about out of our unconsciousness the gestures of the hands. These act upon the brain and mold it. Thus, by practical demonstration, anthropologists learn today that the brain is formed through the influence of the macrocosmic world forces acting on it from without. If this part of the brain to which I refer is injured, there is no speech. If the side of the brain which is ordinarily strongly developed through our right-handedness is freed from the left side, a thing possible in childhood but not in later years, it is shown that the brain actually can be developed through systematic activities from without in such a way that it acquires a center of speech in the corresponding third convolution of the brain, but on the right side. Must we then not say that it is the most erroneous idea imaginable if we think the faculty of speech is developed through predisposition within the brain itself? It is no predisposition within the brain that causes speech, but man himself who develops it by his movements. Out of the macrocosm itself, the faculty of speech is formed within the brain. The organ of speech comes from speech, and not speech from the organ. Let me read that again. The organ of speech comes from speech, and not speech from the organ. This is the discovery made through that most significant physiological fact brought to light by Broca. Through the fact that the gods or spirits of the hierarchies have helped man to carry out such activities as have created for him the seat of articulate speech, the center of speech has been formed within him from without. It is from speech itself that the seat of speech arises, and not the converse. Rightly understood, all such modern discoveries are a complete confirmation of spiritual science. And it is a pity that I can only speak so briefly on such matters. If one were able to speak at length on characteristic changes of this kind, you would see how short-sighted those are who say that spiritual science contradicts modern science. Quite the contrary. It contradicts only the explanations which modern learning gives. It does not contradict that which science gives as facts. Such as we men are through macrocosmic formation during earthly existence is the result of the activity of spiritual hierarchies which have formed us from without. We are verily the result of the macrocosm. As we are today, we are a consequence of the movements of our limbs and of our gestures which carry on a dumb speech. These impress themselves on the brain, which previously did not possess a predisposition for speech. Primal man had not of himself the rudiments of anything, but everything was given to him through the macrocosmic activity of the spiritual hierarchies which formed him. From this we see that with our present consciousness, we are in fact but feeble men. If we desire to project ourselves out into the cosmos, we are confronted with the void. And if we desire to sink down into our own inner depths, we are taken in the toils of our own willful nature. Thereby come those severe trials of the soul which intervene when man seeks to approach the secrets of the world with his present state of consciousness, either from one direction or the other. And when he strives to probe its secrets, concerning which he must feel wonder, because he encounters them first of all as world wonders. Why does this, of which I have just spoken, come about? It comes about because when we penetrate into the far spaces of the cosmos, we come into a region which we have correctly described in the last two lectures as the region of the upper gods or spirits, those who are only the ideas or conceptions of the real gods or spirits. Thus we come into a world which has no dependence. No wonder that what this world can offer us leads us at last into vacuity. Equally, when man endeavors to push forward to knowledge, when he strives upward, whither his thoughts and ideas can penetrate, he attains only to ideas of the gods, and cannot arrive at any true reality. If, on the other hand, he goes down into his own depths, into that which has been forming within him throughout millions and millions of years, he arrives at the deeds, the results, of the other divinely spiritual worlds, which were described in the course of the last lectures as the realms of the subterrestrial, the true gods. But in order to attain to these, we must first push our way through and beyond our own impulses, desires, and passions, through all that lays hold of us there, seizes upon, and changes us so that we must follow it, everything that leads us into egoism and shuts us away from these lower gods. Thus we have the two poles of these trials or probations of the soul. If we wish to approach the upper gods, we reach but the void, a world merely of images. And if we wish to approach the lower gods, all imagery leaves us. We are laid hold of by the maddened impulses of our own inner being, and are consumed by them. Hence the great difficulties of these trials. There is one thing, however, that opens out to us a prospect that is at first purely theoretical. We yet can say, however unsubstantial ideas may be, however unsubstantial everything is that egoism can give us, they nevertheless come from the realms of the universe. And if only we could familiarize ourselves aright with this consciousness of ours, so that we could consider it in its independence as it is in itself, and if it could become ever stronger and stronger, we might perhaps be able to go forward along one road or the other, so that the trial might be endured. We shall here only indicate how it is possible to go forward in a different way than with ordinary consciousness. Let us suppose that we fill ourselves with what has been variously called the Christ impulse. We learn to understand in its deepest significance the Pauline saying, "Not I, but Christ in me." We stand there with our normal consciousness and say to ourselves, "We do not wish to let only this normal consciousness work. We do not wish only to remain in this our personality, but we wish to fill ourselves with the Christ substance, with that substance which the atmosphere of the earth has contained since the mystery of Golgotha." When we thus fill ourselves with it, we do not merely take our own attenuated ideas with us into cosmic space, but however far we go into the realms of space, we still take with us the substance of Christ. All our ideas are then permeated with the substance of Christ. And herewith something highly remarkable appears, which I should like to make clear to you, according to the scientific development of more recent times. Recent scientific development starts with the phenomena of nature, tracing them back to all manner of forces. It then proceeds to what went on in the external world, to light and sound, etc. These are then traced back to vibrations or oscillations of atoms of ether in motion, even to ponderable atoms of matter, and people rejoiced to be able to trace back the whole universe to a world of oscillating atoms of ether or the like. Now, seeing that this method leads to nothing, it has for the most part been set aside. But the consciousness of the general public is behind the times in this particular, for it always remains a little behind scientific progress. The tendency is still general to explain the whole world to the abstraction of vibrating atoms, as though space were filled with nothing but vibrations or oscillations. When, with our ideas and with the empirical experiences that are possible in regard to realities, one encounters such opinions, one feels verily that this so-called atomic world is the void, is emptiness. For these atoms, which people have imagined, do not exist at all. Atoms there can be, in so far as they have an empirical reality, so far as the microscope goes, so far as materiality goes, so long as these are supplied with warmth and light. But to explain light and heat themselves, we must bring to our assistance neither atoms nor vibrations of atoms. For in this case we imagine a cosmic system within the cosmos, and an imaginary cosmic system leads nowhere, for it has no real content. This old atomistic theory has no longer any content. One can follow it in thought, but one feels that nowhere does it grip reality. It is a different thing when we fill our ideas and our abstract laws with that which is in truth the Christ impulse. You all know that as regards this we have not any orthodox creed in view, but the great macrocosmic Christ impulse. We must permeate ourselves with this impulse in the sense of St. Paul. Not our abstract ideas and concepts, but what they are when permeated by the Christ impulse we must carry out into the cosmos as our modern form of consciousness. And here we experience something quite unique. Even as we become poorer and more empty, and our consciousness at last breaks up and falls asunder in the cosmic void, when we go forth with a consciousness uninfluenced by the Christ impulse, so, when we have received it, the further we are able to penetrate into the distant reaches of the cosmos, the richer and the fuller does our consciousness become. Then, when we go still further and attain to clairvoyance, we acquire through our Christ-filled soul abundant psychic substance, till at last the true origins of reality stand before us in their power and grandeur as supersensible realities. Whereas a consciousness without Christ brings us to the void, a Christ-filled consciousness brings us face to face with the real origins of cosmic phenomena, of cosmic, in quotes, wonders. Hence, in my little book, The Spiritual Guidance of Man and of Mankind, you may read that, foolish as such a statement may appear today, there will be in the future a science of chemistry and physics, of physiology and biology, permeated with the Christ impulse, and in many things of which we cannot even dream today, true science will be permeated by the impulse of Christ. He who does not wish to believe this has but to turn over the pages of history to convince himself that the sense of a later age has frequently been the folly of the one preceding it. Let us find comfort in this when we are pitied for accepting the fact that what is held as folly in our day will be the sense of the future. Foolish as it may seem to the humanity of the present to think of a Christian chemistry, it will appear quite sensible to our descendants. Thus, if we can carry the Christ into our conception of the universe, he will give us fullness instead of emptiness. If we follow the other way, if in the Pauline sense and in the spirit of what it has been possible to say here, we fill our souls with the Christ impulse and then plunge down into ourselves, what takes place? The Christ impulse has this peculiarity that it works as a solvent upon our egoism. It works destructively on it. It is a remarkable thing that the further we descend into ourselves with the Christ impulse, the less are we under the power of egoism. We then penetrate more and more into ourselves and learn the nature of man. We learn the whole secrets of man, the world wonder, in that we permeate our egoistic impulses and passions with the Christ impulse. Yes, by means of this Christ impulse, we can go much further still. Whereas otherwise we are thrown back like an Indian rubber ball and do not descend into ourselves, into the realm of our own human organism, when we have Christ in us, we do descend more and more deeply into ourselves, and we come back, as it were, out of ourselves on the other side, so that when on the one side we go out into cosmic realms, we find the Christ impulse everywhere in the far distances of space. On the other side, when we penetrate into the realms of the subterrestrial worlds, we find everything impersonal. We are freed from ourselves. On both sides we find that which surpasses ourselves. We do not vanish when we go forth into cosmic space. We are not dissipated like dust, but we find the world of the upper gods. And when we sink inward, we penetrate into the world of the true gods, that which leads us into ourselves, and also that which leads us into the far realms of the cosmos, might be represented as a circle, where at last we meet with ourselves again. Our will nature, that through which we might otherwise sink as into a realm in which we would be consumed, and that other realm, which is cosmic space, wherein we might be dissipated as into a void, these two meet. Our thoughts about the universe unite with the will, which comes to meet us from out the universe when we descend into ourselves. In such a process, we are no longer confronted with abstract thoughts, but with cosmic thoughts, which are in themselves creative and capable of will. Thoughts capable of will mean divine beings, for will-infilled thoughts are spiritual entities. Thus the circle is completed. While otherwise we should fall into nothingness through the weakness of our own soul, because of the trials we endure, we attain to a certain strength of soul because of the superabundance of egoism we acquire when we sink into our own nature. Thus from two sides we meet with trials of soul, but never with what tells us anything further regarding the world. We must follow both these paths. We must experience both oppositions, fear in face of the void, as well as opposition in our own egoism. And so pushing through ourselves toward the other side of our will nature, and drawing near to the cosmos, we shall become possessed, so soon as we get beyond ourselves in this wise, by boundless compassion, by infinite sympathy for all beings. It is this compassion, this sympathy, which, when the circle is completed, unites with our wide-flung world thoughts, and those which would otherwise vanish into nothing, now assume substantial form. The Christ impulse leads us to the gradual closing of the circle, leads us to recognize what lives and has its being in the realms of space as will-permeated thought. When we have progressed by means of these trials, our souls are purified. We are thoroughly permeated by the purifying process we have undergone. Because in the descent we are to overcome all that the guardian of the threshold reveals to us as temptation to egoism, we are rendered proof against everything that might give rise to fear of the void, fear of being dissipated in cosmic space. It was a wisdom such as this, one which really leads us to the deepest mystery of these soul trials that ruled in the old Greek mysteries. Consequently, the Greek mystics, the disciples of the mysteries, were led to know both the fear of the fathomless abyss and the temptation to egoism, and victory over egoism through infinite sympathy and compassion for all creatures. In the union of sympathy and compassion with thought, they experienced through all these trials a purification of the soul. A faint reflection of all this is seen in the earliest tragedies and dramas of Greece. The earliest dramas of Aeschylus, and in a lesser degree those of Sophocles, help us to recognize for what they really stood. Their purpose was to show, after the manner in which a continuous action is represented on the stage, how fear and egoity could be aroused and lead to catharsis or purification by bravery and pity. Aristotle, who preserved the tradition that the Greek drama represented in miniature the colossal feelings of fear and egoity, of the overcoming of fear by fearlessness, and of egoism by unbounded sympathy or pity, Aristotle knew that the drama was a means of education in miniature, and defined tragedy as a presentation of linked experiences calculated to arouse fear and compassion and to purify the human soul in regard to these qualities. In the course of time, these magnificent truths were lost to the souls of men. When, however, from the 18th and 19th century onward, people again began to study Aristotle, they formed a whole library providing explanations of what Aristotle really meant by this statement. People will first understand what he meant when they realize that drama originated in the old mysteries. Thus the learned can stumble at the very outset of things, for in spite of all the labor expended on the explanation of the concept drama, in quotes, in this library, not much has been gained regarding the Aristotelian definition of fear and pity. We can, however, see how trials of the soul have to arise in the course of the development of man and of the world. We also see how these trials arise through the fact that our soul feels compelled to travel by two ways, the one leading into the distant reaches of the cosmos, and the other into the depths of its own being. The soul must endure these tests, because she cannot have an outlook in both directions. She may, however, hope to close the circle, to find on one side the will and on the other the thoughts, attaining thereby to true realities, to that in which the cosmos is revealed as a spirit that wills, as spiritual willing. What we reach at last is this, that the whole world dissolves into spirit, that we must see spirit everywhere, that we must regard all material substance as the external manifestation of spirit, as the phantasmagoria of the spirit. Because we do not know ourselves in spirit, although we live in it, we have to go through such tests as these. We live indeed in the spirit, but we do not know it. We see the spirit in a deceptive form. And out of this deception in which we ourselves are placed, out of the dream we dream about ourselves, we must press forward to reality. We must strip from us everything that is still material or that reminds us of the laws of material things. This is a path about the end of which we may have some inkling, and from these inklings spring the strength which tells us we shall at last be able to close the circle, and in the revelations of the Spirit may find the solution of the wonders of the world, and satisfaction for the trials of our souls. Therefore a true study of spiritual science must never cause us to be lacking in courage. Even when shown how difficult these soul trials are, and how they have to be renewed again and again, we still may say, we must learn to know them, and indeed endure them, or to know them in the abstract is of no use. We must also have faith that beyond these trials of the soul we shall attain to revelations of the Spirit. Frankly, he who buoys himself up with the thought that the revelations of the Spirit must come one day in any case, and that consequently he need not look out for soul trials, will be the very one to fall straight into them. He, for example, who says, quote, "You presented to us the first Rosicrucian drama, in which we find the development of the soul of Johannes Thomasius, which seemed to show that he had reached a definite height. Now, if we trust to this, we can dispense with the second drama, the soul's probation, and just hope that spiritual revelation will follow. Why need we undergo all these soul tests?" Close quote. Anyone thinking thus would be the very one to bring upon himself the severest trials, for through our normal consciousness, through our intellect, we cannot avoid the trials that must be laid upon us. It were better for us to experience everything in the way of trials of the soul, to get to know them all, and make every effort to understand how even a person like Johannes Thomasius might fall into error and delusion, and make progress only by quite other paths than those we might have imagined. We ought, however, never to lose the conviction that the human soul is intended to bear its divine self upward to the attainment of spiritual revelations. Hence the path of the human soul is this. It confronts the world. This world appears to it as Maya, or the great illusion. It feels that within this Maya, or great illusion, the wonders of the world are hidden. That wonder must emerge as the first test, that then the tests become ever more and more severe. But that the soul can maintain her strength till finally the circle closes, till finally in spirit revelation she finds the solution of the wonders of the world, and attains purification by means of the trials of the soul. That is the path which the soul of man travels, and not the human soul alone, for it is the path to which all the divine hierarchies aspire, and which the human soul accomplishes. In these lectures we have given an outline of the task set before us for this year's cycle, namely to formulate the connection between cosmic wonders, trials of the soul, and revelations of the Spirit. The end of Lecture 10 and the end of this lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner.